Decapod, the podcast for the Roberts Lab NPRB-funded project investigating the effects of bitter crab disease and temperature changes on Southeast Alaskan tanner crabs. All right, welcome to episode one of Decapod. My name is Grace, and I'm the graduate student on this project. I am co-advised by Stephen Roberts at the University of Washington in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences, as well as by Pam Jensen, who is a scientist at NOAA, and she's been involved in hematidinium research for over a decade. This podcast is part of our outreach for this project. If you want more information, you can go to our website, bittercrab.science. All right, so this first episode will provide background information on the issue, as well as a general outline for this project's experimental design. First, I'm going to cut to an informal interview that I did with Pam on why this project is important. She'll talk about bitter crab disease, which is caused by a parasitic dinoflagellate called hematidinium, as well as talk about the temperature component of the project, the goals for what the results from this project will hopefully achieve, and why the Juno crab population, the Juno tanner crab population, is what we're studying. All right, so here we go. What does bitter crab do to the crabs, and why is it a problem?
Well, I mean, it's a problem from our standpoint because it makes crabs taste bad. And the name comes from the common name bitter crab disease because it reminds people of the bitter taste of aspirin. And I never seem to have time, just get too busy out on survey, but I want to try a bitter crab because, well, I worked on it for 15 years. I ought to be able to say, yeah, they taste awful. And just never have time. Plus, I'd have to convince the cook to cook one crab that nobody else is going to want to eat. Mm-hmm. Maybe I can get that done this year. So they taste bad. From the crab's point of view, it's not a good thing because it can kill them, and maybe eventually it does. We don't really know that for sure. But the disease cells, the parasite, proliferates and just fills the blood spaces of the crab. It starts out as a bloodborne disease. The earliest detection by us of hematidinium shows cells in the blood. So it reproduces, it spreads throughout the blood system, and it just becomes densely packed with hematidinium cells. And it's thought that a couple different things are going on. It's interfering with oxygen uptake of the crab tissues and nutrient uptake. And for whatever reason, in an advanced infection, you can see that some of the crab's tissues are breaking down. The muscle fibers are broken up, for instance. And I don't know if that's death because the tissues aren't getting oxygen or if that's some effect from hematidinium waste products in the bloodstream. I don't know. But it's thought that the ultimate cause of death is suffocation. So the crab just doesn't get any oxygen. As they get sicker and sicker, they move around less and finally stop moving around much at all. They don't eat. They can just sit there looking sick, waiting to die for a really long time, based on what we've seen in the lab, like maybe a month. So it's an unpleasant disease for the crabs. Their immune system doesn't seem to recognize it in time to do anything about it. Although you can't say with certainty that there aren't crabs out there that have successfully fought it off, because how would we know? Mm-hmm. But it seems like a pretty nasty parasite.
Yeah.
And probably the crab isn't very successful fighting it off. There's a little bit of evidence coming from the East Coast and blue crabs that if the crabs move into low salinity water, that the parasite has trouble and might die, or at least the numbers might fall in an infected crab. Mm. the Alaskan crabs are not the type of crabs that you find in low salinity waters, and they don't really migrate into low salinity waters. So that doesn't happen with the Alaskan crabs, but might happen on the East Coast with blue crabs. I don't know enough about blue crabs to say definitively, yes, that's what happens, but yeah.
Okay, and then, so the project includes temperature differences, so.
Yes, as we know, climate is changing, and it's thought that the waters in Alaska will warm over time, and these are cold water crabs that we're working with. So a warming of the water is probably going to, is expected to stress them.
Mm-hmm.
Having a disease definitely stresses a host. So if you put the two things together, you can hypothesize that the crabs will be even more stressed than they would with either one on their own. So that's sort of what this experiment was hoping to find out. If there's an effect from temperature or hematidinium on the crabs.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to do that by sequencing transcriptome from crabs held at different temperatures, either infected or not infected with hematidinium.
So like from the results of this, like what's the plan?
Ah, that's like, a very good question. You should always have that in mind. So fisheries is a very applied field, you know, and you're usually working to solve a problem, not just gather information. But we have zero information on snow and Tanner crab transcriptomes. Nobody's ever sequenced them. Nobody's sequenced the genome of either one. The genome of hematidinium has not been sequenced, nor has the transcriptome. Although people are doing some gene expression work, but they're targeting specific genes
mm-hmm.
in other species of crabs with hematidinium infections. So a lot of what we're doing is exploratory. I think one of the larger aims of the project is just to see whether gene regulation or gene expression is affected by the presence of hematidinium and by the temperature changes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we expect that it will be. That seems sort of common sense. And then from that, we can start postulating possible cause and effect relationships with the crabs and the disease organism. For instance, if hematidinium is present, would you expect the crabs to react in this particular fashion, and is that going to make the effects of a warming ocean worse,
mm-hmm.
or no effect at all, or maybe even hematidinium will be useful to the crab. So then you can start to test those ideas. You can say, okay, well, let's look at the genes that regulate oxygen uptake, which is important for the crabs, and as the water's warm, they hold less oxygen. So you might think that the regulation of those genes will change with changing temperature. And what effect will hematidinium have on that?
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, it would be nice to be able to predict which stocks of crabs are going to be affected and how much of an effect there's going to be from changing temperatures and hematidinium. Because at the very least, then you can plan the fisheries
mm-hmm.
kind of to take that into account, or at least let fishermen know there are some tough times coming, or looks like things are going to be okay.
Yeah.
And so.
So this project is only focusing on the Southeast Alaskan, like, Juneau population.
Yes. We chose Juneau for mostly logistical reasons. It was possible to get crabs there and transport them to the lab in a minimal amount of time, which is important because transport of aquatic animals outside of the water stresses them, and there's always some death resulting from transport. You don't want to lose all your crabs. And there's the lab in Juneau that we use. So transport was just a couple hours. And in the Juneau area, historically, the hemadenium infection rate of the Tanner crabs there is 50%, plus or minus 10 or 20%. So we knew that we could find adequate numbers of infected crabs. And that isn't as easy to do in some other places.
Mm-hmm.
Juneau, Southeast Alaska, some of those areas have really high infection rates, which is useful for us, not so much for the crabs.
Yeah.
So, yep. And then there are Tanner crabs in the Bering Sea, of course, and a big fishery for them. There are also snow crabs in the Bering Sea, and we're hoping that the work we do with Southeast Tanner crabs will inform us for, you know, the same sorts of questions for the Bering Sea crabs.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you.
All right. Sure.
Okay, so now I'm going to go into a very, very general outline of the project. So in the fall of 2017, about 400 male Tanner crabs were collected from the waters in Juneau, Alaska. And then they were brought to the NOAA facility where the experiment actually took place. Once the crabs got there, their hemolymph, which is their blood, was sampled. And using conventional PCR, their infection status with hemadenium was determined. So it could have been a 0 for uninfected, a 1 for definitely infected, and a 3 for those who were difficult to actually tell if they were infected or not. So once the crab's infection status was determined and after they were allowed to sort of recover from the stress of being moved, they were separated into 9 tanks. Each tank contained 20 crabs. 10 were infected and 10 were uninfected. And so between 9 tanks, that's only 180 crabs. So all the extra crabs were culled. Over time, the temperature of the tanks was changed to become treatment tanks and a control. So there were 3 tanks that were kept at ambient temperature, which was about 6 degrees Celsius. 3 other tanks were lowered to about 4 degrees Celsius, and 3 others were increased to about 10 degrees. So the crabs were left in these temperature treatment tanks for about 3 weeks, and their hemolymph was sampled at 3 different time points and stored in this chemical called RNA later. And RNA later prevents the degradation of RNA. And then these samples of hemolymph were then transported to the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at UW in Seattle and brought to me. So the next steps of this project, they'll be outlined in more detail in the following episodes as we move through the project. For example, like, I'll have a podcast on just RNA isolation step or whatever. So they'll just be more dedicated to what step we're on in the process of the project. But essentially the goal is to sequence their RNA to get their transcriptomes, which tells us what proteins are being expressed with the different treatments they're in. So that way we can compare what is going on physiologically between crabs that are infected, crabs that aren't infected, and among the 3 different, or between the 3 different temperatures. So, yeah, so like I said, I won't get too much more into it than that, but more information can be found at our website, bittercrab.science, as well as more details to come in the episodes as we continue our research. So yeah, thank you for listening, and be sure to subscribe. Thank you.